Good morning. Escalating costs and little transparency are among the problems with the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation. Today we'll hear what tops the fix list of the new HART board chairperson, Colleen Hanabusa. And a group wants other citizens to put money where their civic values are. Keiko Bonk joins us from the Hui for Good Government. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Bill Sage. Keeping Hawaii green, clean, and beautiful, the Outdoor Circle has been going strong for 104 years. We'll talk with Executive Director Winston Welch about their next century's agenda. And later in the hour, Dr. Ruth Gates gives a look at the toolkit free-floating baby corals use to build our marine reef ecosystems. That's the conversation for Monday, May 2nd. Now the news.
If you could see what's going on in this studio. Good morning. A little something to get you going on a Monday morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and welcome to the conversation, and welcome to Bill Sage, pinch hitting for Chris Vandercook now.
Aloha.
In New York.
It's good to be here, and I feel like, as Poloni Van might say, that today I could get down and bo'ogie. But I know you run a tight ship, and a part of a tight ship is governing the studio. And speaking of good government.
Well, thank you for that nice little segue. Well, you know that a group of citizens is pressing for more effective open government, and they're trying to back their push with crowd-funded dollars. Now, despite pro bono legal help to take on the Office of Elections after the ballot woes of the 2012 election, the Hui for Good Government must cover court cases and other expenses. The group started the crowdfunding page to not only raise money, but to make a point that democracy is everyone's business. But to date, only $120 have been raised, which may be making a point of its own. The Office of Elections case comes up before the Hawaii Supreme Court on the 18th of this month. This morning, Keiko Bonk of the Hui for Good Government is in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Looking at how you came about with this idea of crowdfunding, this seems to be a little bit of a departure from the usual things that we see people trying to crowdfund.
Oh, yes. We're trying this avenue because a lot of people have seen successful campaigns to raise funds on crowdfunding sites. But it's an experiment. We've done direct funding in the past to get some of the legal fees and the clerk work that we needed to continue these three lawsuits.
We've been thinking also about crowdfunding as a sort of a medium that attracts a lot of young people.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been happening with this? I mean, you only have, I know, a few donations, but if you had to put them in a demographic, are they in the younger one?
Well, it's being over the oversight for this TILT crowdfunding campaign is Bianca Isaki, and she's young. And so it's the motivation of these younger people to see if this would be an effective way to create more open government dialogue and also real practical fundraising for these court cases. I think that alongside the TILT effort, we need to have some more media and direct soliciting to the people in Hawaii, because there's, you know, really not that many people actively involved in open government cases and fair government work. And so we need, especially legal work. I mean, you have Common Cause and other organizations doing more efforts to have same-day voter elections, these sorts of kinds of policy changes, and they've been successful. We're going to have that soon in 2018. But in terms of our elections, people are not that connected. And we don't have, you know, as we all know, not that many people vote in Hawaii. In fact, we were the worst state in 2008. And I think now we're not the worst state. I think it's Utah in terms of voter turnout. But we need a fair, open playing ground. And the Green Party versus Scott Nago, the elections head in Hawaii, was one camp, one of the good government projects that we think is very important, because if you can't get even ballots, the right ballots to the polls, and not have delayed ballots and these sorts of things.
And you're harkening back to what happened in 2012
12,
when
yeah.
there were some major kerfuffles at different precincts.
Right. And long waits, people turned away. And then the ultimate challenge was people got the wrong ballots and voted for a district neighboring them.
When you talk about trying to access younger people and through crowdfunding, is there also an issue with, you know, civics education? Because that seems to be kind of a gap, and bridging it seems to be rather difficult.
Well, I believe that there's a pretty much calculated effort amongst power brokers in America to discourage people from voting. And the elimination of civics was just one effort to keep people ignorant about the process of democracy. I don't think we have participatory democracy in Hawaii. I mean, in America. In Hawaii, it's even sort of more stifled because of our history. I think if we had a real powerful elite controlling Hawaii's policies and politics for, even before statehood, a colonial past where the elite ruled. And so, yes, I do think that we have a problem in terms of that. Yeah.
So in the absence of that, what do you see as being the bridge? Because, you know, clearly a crowdfunding page that's trying to get money to be able to defer some of the court cases might be part of that. But your overarching strategy, what do you see that's necessary to be able to get younger people more engaged civically?
Well, I think this is a good start. You know, you have this medium. It's just another medium of doing awareness building and action. And so now you have to develop the campaign around it, which is to go out and, you know, talk to people and build the momentum. I think a lot of campaigns that have that young people have gotten more involved this year because of the Bernie Sanders election sparked and charged a lot of young people to register to vote and these sorts of things. So I think you need younger people going out and actually talking about the fact that there is this avenue for you to get involved, and, you know, and then starting maybe a website where they can go to read more about what's going on and why it's so important for them. But you really got to lobby for multiple things at once, and getting civics back into schools and trying to get younger people to run for office and to challenge, you know, the laws that exist that discourage people from participating. I mean, same-day voter registration is very important because I think getting rid of the whole felony restriction and allowing people, you know, huge demographics don't vote in America. The poor is number one, you know, and minority groups. Asians don't vote that much. Hispanics don't vote. Blacks are voting more and more. They got excited about Obama's race. But there's definitely a white, older, rich voter controlling the electoral politics in America.
Which doesn't seem to be helping your crowdfunding page, but we'll be watching and seeing what happens from here on out. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Keiko Bonk is a member of the Hui for Good Government. If you'd like to find out more, you can take a look at our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HBR2. It's 8:13. Coming up, a look at what some radical environmentalists have been doing for over a century. But first, some historically significant reserve parking places in our backyard.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau. Paraguay, Oahu, Molokai, Lanai, Maui, Kahoolawe, Hawaii.
It may be hard to believe, but Hawaii Public Radio, if it were a person, well, this year it would be just about old enough to run for president. Well, that's an idea. Anyway, it was 35 years ago this coming November that Hawaii Public Radio went on the air for the very first time. University of Hawaii President Fujio Matsuda gave the fledgling public radio station space in the old varsity building near Clum Gym at UH Manoa's lower campus. It was a pretty cramped little location with cardboard egg cartons covering the studio. You know that story. The station soon outgrew its birthplace, and 5 years later, Hawaii Public Radio had its first major capital campaign. And by July of 1987, we moved to our current headquarters on Kaheka Street. Now, for those of us who work here, it's really nice to have assigned covered parking up the ramp on the second floor. But 29 years ago, when we moved in, the building management may not have known if other building tenants would recognize KHPR. And if you've ever been in our parking area, you know what they called us for the benefit of other non-staff would-be parkers. So today we'd like to know if you know what the sign above the staff parking still says. If you think you have the answer, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Two years before the outbreak of World War I, far-sighted individuals in the territory of Hawaii realized they needed to be proactive to preserve the beauty of the islands. In their day, they were considered quite radical. And now, 104 years later, their environmentally responsible efforts are regarded as mainstream, and they hope to be for at least another century. The Outdoor Circle. Executive Director Winston Welch is in studio with some of their next century's agenda. Aloha, Winston.
Aloha, and thank you for having me this morning.
You're very glad to be here. I'm very glad you're here. And the Outdoor Circle, radical environmentalist, set the stage because you also have a history background, and most of these people were women. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, all of the original founders were women, and men weren't even allowed to be members until 1950 with the Kane Kokua membership at that time. But these were really, if we look at it today, feminists who started this organization and people that did not even have the right to vote. So they came together actually in Versailles, and they saw the beauty of Versailles, and they thought, we need that over in Hawaii. So they came back and ended up pressuring local stores to get rid of the ugly billboards that dotted Diamond Head and Punch Bowl. Imagine 10-foot letters high on Punch Bowl advertising soap or whiskey on Diamond Head. And they started a boycott of businesses that advertised. And it was very simple at first. It just said, I refuse to shop in your store if you have these products. And they were even threatened with 20 years of hard labor. You know, it was sort of a whisper campaign to kind of put them down, but they prevailed and ended up becoming this amazing organization that's lasted 104 years and has continued to promote the natural beauty of Hawaii and keeping our islands beautiful for these last 100 years, the next 100 years, you know, we're just sort of starting, as it were, or right in the middle of our path. But
concerned with these uppity women, the next thing you know, they want the right to vote.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing is the Outdoor Circle is not just about opposing things. It's very much works behind the scenes in the thought that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And the organization works with people from all types of the community, whether it's governmental officials or other organizations or companies, to head off problems at the before they come, or to work with them to ameliorate them once they've gotten here, and sometimes to fight, because that's also where the watchdog, where the place where people come in the community.
Essentially, they've been proactive from the get-go?
Proactive from the get-go and have not let up since then. We have a really amazing board of dedicated people, men, women of all ages and backgrounds, and they are certainly go-getters and people that are passionately dedicated to preserving Hawaii's natural beauty.
In the territorial days, it was pretty much in Honolulu and mostly Oahu, and since statehood, it's really spread out to encompass the entire island chain. Is that correct?
That's right. I think that what we had was the branches going to the other islands starting sometime in the 50s in the outer island, the neighbor islands, but mostly it did start here locally in Oahu. We still have about 10 chapters, and we just got a new Greater Waikiki chapter, believe it or not, and with a very dedicated group of people there, and they're having their, coming out event this May 7th with a Jane's Walk in the park, Nanakapiolani Park, and that's part of a larger thing that we're rolling out, which is using our exceptional trees map to essentially layer history and culture and the horticulture of the islands on top of this amazing technological platform that Miles has been in charge of. And along with Jackie, we have a real great staff of dedicated people there as well. So you can see on our website about how this is going to be evolving.
There's one thing I noticed. It really caught my eye. It said that they're also protecting one of the last remaining historic coconut groves, apparently from the 15th century, the Helomoa Grove in Waikiki. Now, does that mean some of those palm trees are close to 600 years old? I have no idea how long these things last.
No, you know, the thing is the Outdoor Circle realizes that trees have a natural life. And mm-hmm. so, but we can go back into historical references about Waikiki or Honolulu, and that it was this dusty, dry place where you would just choke on the dust. And so when we look around at all these great trees, there were 5,000 trees planted by the Outdoor Circle in Kaimuki mm-hmm. alone. They were planted at schools and in parks and on military bases. These were original women took trees and spread them up on Tantalus and carried water by horse and buggy to take care of them. So this is really we realize that plants do have this natural life, but it's time that we need to replace a lot of these trees that our foremothers did plant. And mm-hmm. so this is an ongoing initiative and something that we need to focus on as
nice
well.
Nice catch, our foremothers, because so many were the Wahines that actually did this.
That's right.
Now, one of the other things I'm really intrigued by, it says that the Outdoor Circle is instrumental in creating the establishment of Hawaii's Environmental Court, which is the second one in the nation. And for those of us who profess ignorance, what is an environmental court?
Well, I've been realized I'm just in a line of really great executive directors. Mary Steiner was at the helm for a long time, mm-hmm. and followed by Marty Townsend, who then spearheaded this environmental court. She's over at the Sierra Club now. It is a court that essentially trains judges that specifically follow cases regarding historic preservation, litter control, recycling, solid waste, air pollution, environmental impact statements, and things of that nature. So they become specialists similar to a drug court or a family court so that it's not just thrown out to any judge, but one that rather specializes.
So focusing, for example, when you want some of those, I remember the great banyan tree in the corner of Baratania, and some of these monster trees, we wake up one day and, oh, the city cut it down. Mm-hmm. And apparently this led to great reaction. So they've been proactive in making sure a lot of these historic trees get their day in court, per se?
Well, you know, we do have the Exceptional Trees Program. So if you feel like you have an exceptional tree, please submit it. They're on all of the islands. Miles has mapped all of the trees with some volunteers. And so that's part of our map as well. You can just go online and find out exactly where the trees are from where your location is. It'll guide you there. It'll tell you all about the trees. And we do have a connection to trees. Trees are very important. They're important for our mental, psychological, physical, emotional and financial well-being, and lots of studies are proving this these days. So, yes, if you love trees, I encourage you join the Outdoor Circle. You're already a member, just like everyone's a member of Hawaii Public Radio. Not everyone contributes to it, but if we all contributed and did a little bit more giving of our time, talent, and treasure, we're all going to be better off, because this is the community that we live in, and the green is so important for all of us. And imagine just not having it. But fortunately, we do, for this great organization and all the work that it's done.
Well, I think with the next century coming up, and people like you and the Outdoor Circle, we're going to keep green in Hawaii. I want to thank you very much for being with us this morning, Winston.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Winston Welsh is the Executive Director of the Outdoor Circle. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
He rides a Yamaha and believes Europe is disintegrating.
We had 5 months of trench warfare without, thankfully, bullets and tanks. We had banks, though, being used instead.
Yanis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece, nearly compares himself to George Washington next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio's Spring Pledge Drive reached a successful finish a few weeks ago, and we welcome new members and say thanks to our current members and to these community partners. Hot National Eagle Scouts and Windward Artists Guild for your support during Challenge 2016. As we talked about last week, private prison company Corrections Corporation of America was the sole bidder on the contract to house Hawaii prisoners on the mainland. But with time running out before the contract is inked, there's still time to toughen up what experts say is needed. But will Hawaii do it? With today's reality check, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair is on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
All right, so here we are with part two of this story. Obviously, we've had some conversation about what the contract has been in past, but to just kind of bring us up to right now, what's the difference between what's in the contract now and what experts say really should be added?
Well, there's some things that you would think would be standard for a prison company. And keep in mind, CCA is a for-profit prison. They are in the business of having people incarcerated. And that is good for their bottom line. But what's good for Hawaii's bottom line, that is what's at stake here. So some of the things that they do provide, services that are admirable, is, well, there's access to legal materials for the prisoners. You're allowed to file a grievance. There's a procedure for that. There's educational programs that are being involved, routine medical and dental. You would think those sort of things would be included. But the experts that Louis Kanea talked to said there are some things that would really make it for a much better contract. I'll give you one example. What's known as a policy for liquidated damages. Liquidated damages meaning money. Money that CCA would have to pay should it fail to abide by the terms of the contract. One example there, understaffing. That's a big way for prison companies to save a lot of money, to intentionally understaff their prisons. But of course, when that happens, that leads to all sorts of problems with security and other things like that.
Chad, doesn't there really have to be, shouldn't all of those things be specified exactly what you want to make sure is covered?
As one person, one expert on this pointed out, says, look, unless it's specifically spelled out in the contract, CCA is free to do pretty much whatever it wants to do. So there is actually a liquidated damages policy that we have, but it's fairly limited. It doesn't include things like, well, what if there's a security breach? What if there's injury? What if there is a death? Let me give you another example of things that Louis was advised on that Hawaii should look for. Better monitoring. There is no provision for unannounced inspections. Yes, you can do periodic inspections as the contract is currently worded, but often what happens there is, well, when they know you're coming, that's when they make everything look good. So you show up and everything looks just fine. There was actually a proposal to have audits and biannual reports to the legislature on exactly what goes on. We even had a bill 6 years ago to that effect. Mm-hmm. Governor Lingle actually vetoed that, very similar legislation. So that would be another thing that we might want to consider, unannounced inspections, having regular monitoring, as well as occasional audits, regular audits, rather, of what CCA is doing there in Arizona.
And what about bringing it all back to a body to be the overseer in some way? I mean, we've talked about what that might look like, but shouldn't there be something that is created to create oversight for this?
Yeah, like an ombudsman position, someone to have some authority to go in and keep track of things. But, you know, that has not been the case. Department of Public Safety, by the way, which sent out the contract for CCA, which, as you pointed out, is the only bidder. The contract seemed pretty tailor-made to them, would not comment for this article. So we don't know whether this is going to come up. It may even be too late for this current negotiation. But remember, this is just temporary. It's just for a couple of years. They can't extend the contract. Possibly when we renegotiate in the future, these are the kind of things we may want to consider. But having said that, the more important goal, I think, for folks here in Hawaii is to bring people back home. Remember, if there's room to house those prisoners here in Hawaii, or even to have less of them take up our prison space, then we wouldn't need to sign contracts with companies like CCA.
And that's the bottom line, and that'll be certainly a lot of conversation as we go forward. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks,
Talk
Beth.
To you tomorrow. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Good morning. I'm Bill Sage, and it's 8:30. You're tuned to the conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Talk back about what you hear in the show on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. You can also email us at talkback at Hawaii Public Radio. And now news from the BBC.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back on the heyday of LA's punk scene, with John Doe, Exene Cervenka of the band X, and Dave Alvin of the Blasters. Doe has put together a new book about those early days. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozek. And today we have a kind of serious discussion about teens and depression. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. We're going to talk about when it's not just being a moody teenager, what happens, and how can people recognize when there's a serious issue that requires medical attention.
So you have some kids that are just, making that fine distinction. What are some of the warning signs?
Well, you know, we've all gone through being moody teenagers, but when that starts to actually affect how we function with family, how we function at school, and there are some warning signs we'll talk about teenagers and when they're starting to get really depressed or even starting to think about harming themselves or others, they exhibit certain behavior characteristics that we're going to discuss today that really any family member might be able to pick up on. But we're really going to look at what can everyone do to help. We all know someone who has a teenager. What can we do to make them go through this transition that is not just age-related but hormone-related and related to all these different factors of what's going on in their lives that seems so incredibly important and life-altering? And how do we get those folks to feel comfortable enough to share what's going on in their lives and bring them to a safe environment?
So it's not always necessarily drugs or alcohol.
It could just be growing up.
Yeah. And that's going to be the subject tonight. We look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozek tonight at 5.
I'm Craig Howes from the Center for Biographical Research at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
You may remember that once the cost to build Oahu's rail was estimated at $5.3 billion. Now the projection is $6.6 billion and counting for the 20-mile line. Add to cost overruns, a lack of transparency in communications, questions of mismanagement, and the scathing rail audit, and controversy continues to swirl. Newhart Board Chairperson Colleen Hanabusa knew all of that coming in. With only a few weeks since her appointment, what more is in her plan to rebuild confidence and contain costs? We're going to find out as Colleen Hanabusa joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Hi, Bethann. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks, and thank you very much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, you can literally start counting on your fingers and toes all the issues that we've had with the rail project since, you know, it began. But of late, we've seen so many come so fast and furiously. A lot of people are wondering, is there going to be really a way out, and can you really rebuild confidence in this project? What have you been learning in the last couple of weeks since you've taken over as board chair?
Well, you know, I've been on for less than about 10 months now. my appointment was supposed to expire on June 30th, and I was filling in the last year of Carrie Okinaga's term. But even from that point, I felt that there were issues that the public needed to be aware of. I think it's also the board has taken on, I think, a more active role than you've seen in the past. People have told me that before, like, I got on, both the committee meeting and the board meetings were done in 2 hours. If we're done by starting at 8:30, done by 2, it's good. And when I first took over as chair, we'd finished at 4 in the afternoon, only because I ran out of a quorum. So I think when you talk about transparency and information to the public, you will see a change in this board. What we're planning to do, and hopefully it will happen before the end of this month, is to hold, for example, like Transit 101 is what the staff has pitched it to me as. And what we're going to do is have a board meeting, a special board meeting called at night, so people can make it in a venue, and to actually take them to the first phases of this project to show what it takes. Because I think for most people, unless you're driving from the Waianae coast or Kapolei in, you're not seeing how what we call the WOOF, the West Oahu Farrington Highway section, and now into Kamhaui, how that has progressed, simply because it's out there and people out there have had to live with it. So I think what we're going to do first is we're going to have, like, for all of us, including the board members, a visual as to what this means. Not, quote, sugarcoating anything. I'm going to give it to you, show you where the problems are, because as you know, from the time I got on the board, I've been a critic of the fact that I did not believe we looked at utilities and utilities relocation objectively, primarily what we call the 138 kV lines, which is a very expensive process.
And having enough clearance for all of that.
Pardon?
And having enough clearance for all of that.
Right.
Yeah?
The lack of clearance then requires them to be underground. Once you dig up a road, everyone knows. Who knows what you're going to find, and who knows what's going to happen. But the major thing is the huge inconvenience to the public. It's more than just construction alone, because construction is the pillars for the guideway. But when you're doing an underground and you're digging that whole thing laterally for 1.6 miles or however it may be, and then you have to put the lines in, and there's more than one line. There's a series of lines that have varying depths. So it's a complex matrix that we've got to work our way through. One of our staffers told us that they're going to show, and we're going to make it so the public can see exactly all the utilities that are underground now on Dillingham Boulevard that are going to need to be moved or somehow adjusted out of the route.
Okay,
and,
so that's
know what we're going to. It's not going to be easy. But the best thing we can do is to share it with the public so the public can
I understand that. But as far as seeing the physical part of it that has to move and understanding all that, that's one thing. But understanding, too, and feeling confident in the people who are managing it is something quite different. You were wondering, at least publicly, what kind of power the board had relative
right.
to what has been going on with, say, Dan Grabauskas and how the project's been managed. Are we really looking at a showdown between what's happening with the board and the Hart management?
Well, there's another aspect of this that people are forgetting, which is the true power on how the management structure of Hart is going to be operated will be with the charter amendments that you're going to vote on come November. So the Charter Commission, on top of everything else, is also looking at the governance structure, and this portion of the charter is under heavy scrutiny from what I understand. And, you know, I've just come on as chair, but they are looking at exactly the question, which is who has the ultimate say on the governance of Hart? Who is Hart is actually a fundamental issue. Who is Hart? Is Hart Dan Grabauskas, or is Hart the board? I mean, the board has passed resolutions recently which said that before anyone can say they spoke for Hart to the Hawaii State Legislature, for example, they needed the Hart board to actually vote. Imagine, it wasn't done before. The majority of the board had to agree to whatever the testimony that was being submitted. We just passed one for the city council as well. But imagine, up until then, there wasn't a clear delineation as to who is Hart. And when you have that, then it's easier for people to kind of punt and say, well, that's not within our kuleana. It's somebody else's kuleana. So in order for us to even think about gaining public confidence, we need to get to the point where people see that we're actually, one, addressing the fundamental issue. And the fundamental issue is, who is Hart? And the people will have a say as to who is Hart when the Charter Commission amendments come up. If they vote them down, it's going to be, we're going to stay in this limbo situation that we've had up until now. And if we pass, the people vote to pass whatever changes is put on the charter, then we'll have a change in structure, and you will be able to hold whoever the Charter Commission believes should be responsible for the actual ultimate decision-making that's being done.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with those charter amendments come November. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks
to you
again.
Aloha.
Former Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa is the board chairperson of the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation.
In our backyard this morning, we told you about the birth of Hawaii Public Radio 35 years ago. Back in 1981, with cardboard egg cartons on the studio walls for soundproofing in the old varsity building on the UH Manoa Lore campus near Clum Gymnasium, HBR started out with a staff of only 2 people, but its excellent programming gained it a faithful and growing listening audience. By 1986, it was rapidly outgrowing the original home, and the search for a bigger and better location led to HBR finding its current studios on Kaheka Street. We also mentioned that HBR staff greatly appreciated the fact that they had covered indoor parking up the ramp on the second floor. Well, they still do. But for our quiz, we wanted to know if you know how the building identified our reserve parking. If you've ever been in our parking area, you'd know. And here's why. We never took down the old sign from 1987. It's still there, and it says, "Reserved for the stereo station." And so we still are, a stereo station. We like to think your favorite stereo station. It's 844, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you could send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
So
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Compassion and Choices, a nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. Learn more about contributing personal stories at compassionandchoices.org/Hawaii.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, for the details, we turn to Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars and Saturn in your evening sky. Now, both planets are incredibly bright and very easy to spot. Now, as we move into May, something very cool is going to happen. Mars and Saturn will form a triangle with the bright star Antares in the constellation of Scorpius, which you can see towards the south.
And you mentioned Saturn, and I believe you've got some news on a probe that went in that direction.
That's right. In 1997, the Cassini-Huygens spacecraft blasted off on a 7-year journey to the ringed giant Saturn. Since then, this remarkable spacecraft has been studying the Saturn system in unprecedented detail. But unfortunately, all good things must come to an end, and this historic mission will shortly be drawing to a close. And as Cassini approaches the final act, it will once again turn its eyes towards Saturn's moons and to the giant planet itself.
So how do they wrap it up? Does it sort of just run out of power, or what signifies the end?
Well, Cassini is powered by plutonium, and so in theory, it could last for years and years more. But the scientists at NASA are very conscious about the environmental impact this plutonium can have, and so Cassini will embark on a daring series of maneuvers that will see it plunge through the rings of Saturn and eventually end in a fiery deorbit to the giant planet itself.
What have we learned about those moons?
Well, the Cassini mission started off with a spectacular landing of the first deep space probe. It was called the Huygens probe, and it landed on the surface of Titan, a moon that is thought to represent primitive Earth. Cassini also visited the mysterious moon Enceladus, and it has shown us that there is potential for an ocean beneath the surface of this icy moon. And indeed, Cassini has seen plumes of oxygen and water coming out from cracks in the surface.
Sounds like it's shown that Saturn's moons are a lot more alive than many people thought.
They really are. And the good thing about the Cassini mission is that Cassini will continue to stream back data right until its final hours. So who knows what other remarkable discoveries we'll learn about as this probe approaches its end.
Christopher Phillips and another exciting Stargazer report. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
It's hard to imagine how very tiny creatures can construct homes that are visible from space, but that's exactly what reef-building baby corals actually do. They use a coral toolkit, if you will, to transform from floating larvae to stay-at-home reef construction experts. Would you believe biomineralization? Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology researcher and director Dr. Ruth Gates is with us this morning to explain how it happens. Welcome, Ruth.
Thanks very much, Bill. I'm delighted to be here.
All right. For those of us not too familiar with biomineralization, this is here's a little critter, and it's got lots of other little critters living with it, inside it.
It does.
Symbiotes?
Yes. So corals are really, they're magnificent organisms. They have managed to harness the energy or the function of other creatures. And so corals have these tiny, tiny little plants living inside of themselves. And they live in this really mutualistic and very beautiful relationship where they communicate with one another. The plants do what all plants do. They use sunlight energy to fix carbon dioxide and water into a small food that it then gives to the animal. And so essentially corals have a food factory living inside of themselves. And this relationship is really what underpins coral reefs globally, these incredible structures that really harbor enormous amounts of biodiversity that we use. Coral reefs are critically important to man. So this relationship is the center of the universe for a coral, and frankly, it's what enables the coral to start to lay down the hard structure or their skeletons. Mm-hmm. And it's these skeletons that create the structures that are reefs.
Now, and these are essentially calcium carbonate, right?
Exactly. So bone, just like we have bone inside of us that gives us structure, corals have bones inside of themselves that gives them structure and allows them to create three-dimensional structure.
But it's the process which is sort of mysterious. Now, essentially, mommy and daddy coral do what all mommy and daddy coral do, and the little baby corals have essentially one-celled zygotes, fertilized egg and sperm. And then they sort of grow to a certain thing, and the parents go, good luck to you, go find a home, now get out of here, you're on your own. And they're swimming around freely looking for a home, but somehow they stop wandering and want to settle down just like mom and dad. So the mechanism of settling down, that's the mystery you guys have uncovered?
That's right. So what we've been really looking at is what makes a coral go from swimming around. These baby corals are swimming around in the water column. They find a place that they think they want to live in for the rest of their life because, of course, this decision is that decision. And at that point, things have to happen within their molecular machinery mm-hmm. that stops them swimming and has them sit down to the bottom and then start to lay down, have the capacity to start to lay down calcium carbonate skeletons. And so what we've done is to, first of all, identify the alphabet of genes that are present and involved in that process, and then looked at the sequence or the dance between these different elements or genes as time goes by and as they develop from a free-swimming larva to a coral that's putting down skeleton.
Do they get sort of coralline real estate agents saying, here's a great location? What the signal comes up from someplace?
That's right. The signal to sit down comes from a red sort of creeping thing on the bottom that we call a crustose coralline algae. And they give off a chemistry or a chemical, a pheromone, that attracts these tiny little larvae. And they sniff this pheromone out.
Sort
they
of a red it. Algae district.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Bill. You've got it. So they sniff
toot,
the...
Toot, beep, beep. Sorry.
And so they sit down and they become a small calcifying object that then can grow into a whole colony. Because remember, corals start as one tiny little polyp, mm-hmm. which is essentially just a ring of tentacles with a mouth and the skeleton underneath them. And then they are clonal, so they reproduce by adding independent units that are connected to each other that are all genetically identical to create an individual colony. Now and each of these colonies grows into a reef.
If I may, the algae within, is it contributing to the biomechanism by which the calcium phosphate can be made?
Absolutely. It's a calcium carbonate. And
carbonate, certainly.
Yeah, so the carbonate and the symbiosis between the algae and the animal actually accelerates the rate at which that process happens. And in ways that we're just beginning to understand, frankly.
And essentially the calcium is just ions free-floating in the seawater?
That's right. And they are actually in the seawater. They're moved through the tissues of the coral to mm-hmm. where the site of calcification is, which is inside the tissue. So essentially you have the skeleton, a layer or veneer of tissues that stretches over the skeleton, and these symbionts or algae that are dark brown that give the coral their characteristic coloration mm-hmm. and can be seen really through the transparent tissues of the coral.
Exoskeleton, sort of exoendo. They keep migrating?
It's definitely underneath the tissue. So it's really, you know, I suppose you would call it an endoskeleton, but really it is something that grows on the substrate. The animal tissue is over it all the time in a thin veneer.
And yet this thin veneer is very thin in terms of delicacy because of changes in the environment.
That's right. And so, you know, the corals and reefs have been in the news a lot recently with the global bleaching that is going on. And it is, you know, this is really a reflection of the breakdown of the symbiosis that we've just been discussing, that for some reason these warmer-than-normal temperatures impair the ability of these tiny plant cells inside the animal to communicate with their animal. And the animal sees them now as foe and gets rid of them. And so what was originally dark turns white, and that reflects the loss of these tiny plant cells.
Is it possible with further research into how it's done to possibly modify it genetically to enable it to cope with the warmer temperatures?
You know, there's a lot of really interesting work going on. You know, we know that there are some types of plants or tiny plants that are strains that are actually more thermally tolerant than others. And so we're looking at whether or not you can potentially introduce the most thermally tolerant into all corals, give them a leg up to get through these very stressful warming times. Because let's face it, our future ocean is going to be warmer and more acidic, the double whammy of climate change.
Well, I hope that research manages to get these little critters to keep building. Thank you so much for being with us this morning, Ruth. I wish we could talk longer, but unfortunately my mouth is running out of speech.
Thank you very much, Bill. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Ruth Gates is the director of and researcher at the Hawaii Institute for Marine Biology, University of Hawaii, Manoa, Mokualoa, Coconut Island. She's the elected president of the International Society for Reef Studies. Find out more on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the law firm Alston, Hunt, Floyd, and Ng, serving clients and the community in Hawaii for a quarter century. More information online at ahfi.com.
What color are the Easter eggs in Greece?
Usually they're red because of the Passion of Christ and the blood of Christ.
Get expert tips for enjoying the smaller towns of England.
And they have a fabulous museum there.
And Mexico's leading author explains a paradox of living in his country.
Things are going very bad, and at the same time, we are capable of having a very good time.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tuesday at 4 p.m., following Fresh Air.
Listening to your interview with Dr. Ruth Gates, I didn't want her to stop. I was like, and then, and she tells it so well because she loves those creatures so much.
What's also wonderful for me is the fact that although she and I speak fluent nerdish, it still becomes accessible to the average person just looking, because you look at those beautiful shades around the seas around Hawaii and you realize so much of the water's beauty is because of the coral so close to the surface producing that. And just the art that is living that's got to be preserved, it's there, and she makes it understandable that humans can help it to happen.
And we're going to watch and see what happens with some of that research, particularly as she was talking about those thermal-tolerant tiny plants, and if, well, they'll actually be brought in and able to be used by the corals.
That
or
might
not
actually be a GMO that's beneficial if,
well,
it happens.
Well, we'll see
that
what
way
happens. Life is changing. We know that part. As my grandmother always said, nothing endureth like change. Right now, we're going to change over into the 9 o'clock hour and say goodbye to you for today, but we'll be back tomorrow. And we're going to find out what Neil Conan is thinking about from the farm.
Plus, the Olympic decathlon champion Brian Play. Meanwhile, you can be in touch. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or you want to hear any of that again about the corals or anything else we've talked about today, you can find the show on the Conversation page. It also has links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll both be back tomorrow morning with more of the Conversation. See you.